We're looking at an unthinkable crisis. You think all of the unsterilized animals on the streets, having litters of puppies and kittens, and in a few months, I don't even want to think about how many of these animals aren't going to survive.
Welcome to The Consult Room, the podcast that celebrates pets and people. I'm Dr. Paul Magtalo. I'm a veterinary surgeon with a passion for the rich insights and stories about pets in the modern world that we live. Whether you're a pet owner, a pet professional, or you just love hearing about pets, then this is the space for you.
Before we start this episode, I just wanted to give you the heads up that we are talking about animals in desperate circumstances that some listeners may find upsetting. I'm going to start this episode by reading an extract from a piece written by a journalist who is reporting from Ukraine. The inhabitants of the village had fled overnight, leaving these poor creatures to live abandoned and alone. A slow and agonizing death lay before them. They had no food and had to live with the terror of constant explosions. We even managed to get one of the dogs free. He was locked inside a house, and it was the captain of the soldiers who opened the door for him, risking being bitten by an animal that was both starving and terrified in equal measure. Today, I'm joined by Greg Tully, who is the country director of Save the Dogs and Other Animals. Greg is calling us from Romania, where he is currently managing the charity's response to the crisis in Ukraine. Greg's work in the animal welfare sector has taken him all over the world, to Nepal with the Kathmandu Animal Treatment Centre, to Southeast Asia with the Soy Dog Foundation, and to Africa, where he was the CEO of Pan-African Sanctuary Alliance. Greg, welcome to the consult room.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Greg, you're calling in from Romania right now. What is the situation out there?
In Romania? Well, it's we're in a rural part of Southeast Romania where there are a lot of street dogs and street cats. It's, just walking to the supermarket, you can't miss them. And so I work for Save the Dogs and Other Animals, and one of our major goals is to sterilize and take care of these, sterilize the dogs and cats to reduce their populations humanely. And also, we provide emergency medical treatment for animals who have, injured, ill, any sorts of other problems. There are abandoned pets that we rehome. And so it's a lot of work taking care of these animals. There's a huge number. And also, another big part of what we do is awareness and education, helping people live better with their animals. We educate children about compassion for animals. We help disadvantaged farmers take better care of their working horses and donkeys. So it's a pretty comprehensive approach.
So Save the Dogs was a charity in Romania, which existed well before the war in Ukraine. But can we go back to the first few days when Russia invaded and how that changed what you were doing as a charity?
Yeah. So Save the Dogs has been working in Romania for 20 years. And actually my first day here was the last day of February of 2022, just a few days after the war started. So in my first day in a new job, we had meetings and decided, we need to make Ukraine a priority. We're just 2.5 hours driving from the Ukrainian border. So we're in a really strong position to, send supplies, provide support, act as a staging area. And so we decided it's such an urgent issue. And with all the animals and the people that were suffering, we needed to take action. But of course, with disaster responses, it's always chaotic. And it's hard. It was hard to get reliable information about what was happening and what the needs were. A lot of animal protection organizations wanted to get involved, but no one was really sure what to do in the beginning. So we went to the border at Isace. It's a border crossing across the Danube River, and we saw countless Ukrainian refugees coming across, and a lot of them had pets. Some of them had these animals just, a little dog or a cat just wrapped up in their jacket. They didn't have any pet supplies, pet food, leashes, collars, pet carriers. So one of the first things we did was to decide to have a presence at the border every day, helping these refugees, giving them the supplies they needed, giving them pet food, giving them advice about traveling with their pets. A lot of them didn't realize that, you need a pet carrier to bring a pet on an airplane. And so we were just giving them, I mean, even just giving them a safe place where they could sit down and warm up and charge their phones. And sometimes they would just burst into tears. You know, they'd finally escaped Ukraine. They were in a foreign country. They didn't know the language. They didn't know where to go next. And we were giving them a safe place where we could take care of their dog, make sure their cat had some food, and let them sort of reset and figure out where to go next.
I've heard some statistics that, you know, the people displaced from the war in Ukraine, and it's around 8 million people that have fled, you know, to Europe, and around 6 million have been internally displaced. But do you have any idea how many pets and other animals have been displaced? Because those numbers are huge, aren't they? And I presume, you know, a significant proportion of the population in Ukraine did have pets.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, no one has figures about that. We've looked, but you're right. A lot of people in Ukraine have pets. I mean, even before the war, Ukraine had a substantial population of street dogs and street cats, and also a lot of them had people to take care of them, and also dogs and cats living in people's homes. So you can imagine, you know, some people were able to bring their pets with them when they left their homes, and a lot of people didn't. I mean, there are people. I mean, Ukrainian men have generally not been able to leave the country because of the draft for the war. So a lot of the refugees have been, you know, one woman with kids and maybe a pet or two if they could bring it with them. But if they had, you know, large dogs or too many kids, they left the animals behind. So it's an absolutely overwhelming number. I mean, no one can really calculate it, but it's just from the trips that we've taken into Ukraine, the number of abandoned pets is absolutely shocking. And these aren't, you know, I've worked in places where there are street dog populations of animals that live on the streets. They're pretty street smart. They know where to find food. I mean, a lot of these are just people's pets that lived in their house their whole lives. And then they've been wandering the streets, just desperate, you know, no idea how to stay warm or how to find food.
And, you know, as a dog owner and, you know, the thought of having to make that decision is just, you know, is incomprehensible to me. You know, I can't imagine, you know, how desperate and traumatic that was for those people. But, you know, once they've fled and, you know, if they've had to abandon pets, once they've seen you, for example, at the border and doing the work that you do, did anybody try and get you to, you know, to go and get their animal? Because it would feel so hard, wouldn't it, seeing people working with, you know, with animals at the border and seeing people that have brought pets with them. What was it like in that place at that time?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, these people were in, you know, one of the hardest points in their entire lives. And so it's, you know, we did everything we could to help them, but emotionally it was really difficult on our staff and our volunteers. You know, we were at the border every day for months, and it was, we would rotate people in and out because it was just so emotionally taxing. And some people did ask us to take care of the animals that they brought with them. You know, they brought their animals from Ukraine to the border and across into Romania. And they said, you know, I just can't keep doing this. This is too difficult. Or I need to go stay with family in Hungary, Poland, somewhere else. And so there were cases where we accepted those pets and then we reunited them with their people later. Just sort of logistically challenging, but also really rewarding. I really hope that, you know, whenever the war ends, people will go back and some of them hopefully will be able to find their dogs and cats again that they left behind. It won't be easy, but I hope they do.
And it was interesting you say there that you had to keep switching the volunteers out that were working on that front line just because of the sheer emotion of it. Like what were they telling you about how difficult that was?
Oh, I mean, you can imagine these people are, you know, they were talking to people all day who had to very suddenly pack up a few possessions, leave their home. Because of the draft, their adult men weren't allowed to leave. So they were leaving behind fathers, husbands, sons. They didn't know if they'd ever see them again. They didn't know if they would see their homes again. And they were going through, I mean, some of them traveled for days, you know, and if the lucky ones had a car, if they didn't, they were walking, trying to find other sources of transportation. Then they finally crossed the river into Romania and they just sort of broke down and let all these emotions out. And you try to give them the emotional support that you can using Google Translate or find there were volunteer translators around. But it's hard. I mean, what do you say to someone in those situations? You can't just say it's going to be okay, because that's meaningless.
And like from what I've read in the reports, it wasn't just the people that were fleeing with animals. It was, like you said, people that couldn't then, you know, they made the decision to grab their pet and you take them with them. But then they were faced with other challenges, getting on planes, getting on trains, and they couldn't continue. So again, there's the emotion, the trauma of having to leave your pet at that place as well. And I heard reports that there were, you know, dogs tied up at railway stations and things like that. Is that something that your team had witnessed?
We saw, I don't know if we saw any dogs in the process of being abandoned, but definitely the number of dogs and cats wandering around at the border increased a lot during that time. So there were people who just couldn't take care of their animal anymore and they just let it go and walked away. So that became one of our volunteers' roles, was not just taking care of the refugees and the refugees' pets, but also this sort of growing population of dogs and cats that were wandering around aimlessly, and, you know, giving them food, getting them sterilized, giving them vet treatment when they needed it. So that was another one of our responsibilities at the border.
So it feels like there's almost like kind of three, you know, populations of animals here. There's the people that are fleeing with their pets that you need to support. There's the people, you know, the pets that have been abandoned at borders. And then there's the pets that, you know, that are still in Ukraine that have also been abandoned. How do you even start to plan of how you're going to help all these, you know, all these animals? How did you even start to plan that?
Yeah, it was confusing at the beginning. I mean, we really made an effort to stay in contact with other organizations responding to the Ukraine disaster, from the big global animal charities to, you know, Eastern European ones, to coordinate efforts, collect all the information that we could. I was in a lot of weekly group calls with other organizations to get information about what was happening at the various borders and the progress of the war and where help was needed. And also, quickly, you know, social media was invaluable. You know, we were posting on Save the Dog social media a lot about our work for Ukraine, and Ukrainian people were reaching out to us. You know, people who run animal shelters, people who just animal lovers who had taken abandoned pets into their homes or started feeding the strays on the streets. And so, you know, we quickly developed a robust network of especially people in Ukraine, and we're still in touch with them every day now. And so they were really our eyes and ears on the ground. You know, in the early days when we decided it wasn't safe enough for us to send our own staff in there, we would rely on these networks of people. I mean, a lot of them had lost their jobs, or they were sort of stuck, and helping animals on the streets actually gave them kind of a purpose. You know, instead of just sitting at home unemployed, they were being able to do something positive. And so we learned from them about what the needs were and the logistics of it. And you know, we sort of quickly learned how to export supply pet food and other supplies from Romania and import it to Ukraine, and what documents are needed. And then so we started sending tons and tons of dog food and cat food and you know, flea and tick collars, dog houses, blankets, and so we'd send them to some of our contacts who had rented storage spaces. And then from there, they distribute them to other people we're in touch with, other partners of Save the Dogs, and from there to other volunteers. And so through these networks, I mean, now the pet food that we're sending is reaching 109 different cities and towns and villages across Ukraine, and thousands of dogs and thousands of cats. And so, I mean, the logistics are, you know, substantial, but through these networks and through these really dedicated, amazing Ukrainian people, they're really doing most of the work.
I really struggle with the idea of having to abandon, you know, my own dog. And, you know, I've already said that is the bit about this that really hits me quite hard. But for the volunteers, how did it feel for them to see these dogs who are ultimately their pets on the street, aren't they? It's not like, you know, if you work for a charity that's used to dealing with, you know, these street animals who are, you know, a little bit smarter, a little bit more kind of, you know, self-sufficient, if you like. How was it for your volunteers to see that these were pets and they had to be, I presume, treated in a different way?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question. And they really form emotional bonds with these animals. I mean, there's one woman I can think of, Jana, who lives near Odessa, and she feeds, I mean, hundreds of, not just feeds, she takes care of, you know, hundreds of abandoned dogs in an industrial area of Odessa. And she has emotional connections with every one of them. You know, she's feeding the same puppies day after day. They get parvo. She brings them to the vet clinic. If there aren't enough donations available, she pays for the treatment out of her own pocket. You know, those puppies get better. She brings them back to the, you know, the abandoned shack where they live. And then she finds others with parvo and takes them to the clinic. And it's really, yeah, I mean, we talk about feeding street dogs. It's not just dumping out food on the sidewalk. It's their hearts are in it. And they've said so many times how grateful they are to Save the Dogs and to Blue Cross for making this possible, you know, for donating supplies, donating tons of pet food. I mean, at this point, Save the Dogs has given more than 700 tons of pet food to Ukraine. And so it's a real collaboration, but they're very emotionally connected with the animals they're helping.
Yeah. And, you know, going back to this this question I've got about, you know, these animals not being necessarily hardy or street smart. We went into winter, which is, you know, bitterly, bitterly cold over there. But in a lot of areas was compounded by lack of water, lack of food, lack of power. But how did these animals survive? And did they? Were you finding that a lot of them were not making it through the winter?
Fortunately, in the areas where our partners are, because of this network that we have, we didn't hear many accounts of dogs and cats not surviving. I mean, I've heard secondhand, thirdhand in other areas of Ukraine, things were a lot worse. But thanks to Blue Cross and other supporters of ours, we donated dog houses and blankets to give the animals a place to get out of the snow and to stay warm, and the pet food also, so they can, you know, keep on calories, so that they can keep up their, you know, their body mass and stay warm. And so it really enabled thousands of animals to get through the winter. But I know there are other parts of Ukraine. I mean, it's a big country, and even with all the various animal charities that are working there, it's just not nearly enough. And so there are, you know, other areas where things have been a lot tougher on the animals, and I'm sure a lot of them didn't make it through the winter.
And obviously, you know, the primary thing here is the humanitarian crisis of the war. And I suppose my question is, you've got all these animal charities that are coming in and, you know, doing these phenomenal efforts to protect the, you know, the animals and the welfare of the animals involved. But I guess, are governments purely focused on dealing with the human side of things, and it's left to you guys to try and do whatever you can to help animals?
Yeah, it's true. It's really, I think it's on the nonprofit sector to take care of these animals. And of course, you know, we can't say animals are more important than people, or that, you know, resources from the Red Cross or the UN should go to animals, but I think this underscores the importance of, you know, partners and donors all around the world who've made this work possible. It's all possible just because of donations. And a lot of these donations are, you know, 10 pounds, 20 pounds that all make it possible.
So Greg, what would happen if you guys weren't there to help these animals? What would the situation be like right now?
I mean, I hate to say it, but if without Save the Dogs help, thousands of dogs and cats would not have survived the winter. You know, a lot of our partners in Ukraine, I mean, we have a network of, you know, dozens of people, and a lot of them have said, we're the only organization that's helping them. You know, without us sending food and sending other supplies, they would have nothing to work with. You know, most of these people haven't had jobs in more than a year now because of the war. And so, yeah, it's sad, but a lot of animals wouldn't have survived. A lot of puppies and kittens would have died on the streets.
And it really, you know, underlines how important the work is that you're doing. But does that hang over you with a huge sense of responsibility as well? Because, you know, surely that must add a huge amount of pressure onto yourself and the organization that you have to keep going with this work.
Yeah, it's a huge burden. It's really tough to think about. I mean, fortunately, we've had, you know, partner organizations that have been giving to us, not just in the first months of the war when it was in all the headlines, but also in the months and months since then. But it's tough. Sending food aid isn't a sustainable solution. Just donating, you know, we've been sending, you know, 20 to 80 tons per month of dog and cat food to Ukraine. And it's impossible to continue that forever. It's just not sustainable. And so it really worries me. It that weighs heavily on me about what's going to happen. I mean, I hope that the partners in Ukraine can find other sources of support. I hope that the economy will improve. Of course, we all hope the war will end soon. But the need for donations is so urgent. I can't say enough about that. This is completely fueled by donations from people and charities around the world.
And it feels like you've got, obviously, you had the huge immediate crisis when the war started. You've now got this ongoing crisis, if you like. But even if the war was to stop tomorrow, like, how long do you think charities like yourselves would still need to have a presence in Ukraine to help the situation? Because it now must be, you know, a real crisis of, you know, roaming street populations and breeding and public health risks and all sorts of things like that. So how long do you think that's going to take to resolve?
I think it's impossible to say, but we're talking about, you know, at least months and very possibly years, because Ukraine had a substantial population of stray dogs and cats before the war. And now with all these abandoned pets, you know, some people will be able to go back and find their pets again, and most of them won't. So there's a huge sudden increase in the number of animals living on the streets. And so before the war, the shelters in Ukraine were pretty much at capacity, and now they're just overflowing, completely overwhelmed by the problem. So there's going to be a real urgent need to build the capacity of these shelters. I mean, we would love to go in and repair shelters that were damaged by the war, help them, you know, work with them to work to better standards, provide better care for animals, increase the shelters so they can take in more animals, and increase adoption programs. But there's this capacity building phase of it. I think once the emergency aspect of the war is over, there's going to be a real need for building capacity of the volunteers and the organizations that are helping these animals, and that could, you know, easily take years.
So I've heard reports of people working in these rescue centers that are actually refusing to leave areas despite it being quite dangerous, because there's nobody else there to feed and to care for these animals. Is that the case? Have you come across that?
Yeah. We visited some villages, especially villages near Kherson and Mykolaiv, where we see a village where there were probably thousands of people living there, and now there are literally 20 or 30. And it's awful. You know, there's no electricity. There's no running water. Water has to come in by truck. And we asked some of these people, you know, why are you still here? And some of them said, you know, for years, they'd been feeding the local outdoor dogs and cats, and they just couldn't leave these animals behind. So they're living in underground bunkers or living in shacks because every house in the village has been damaged and is uninhabitable. And they're staying there for the animals. And it's just incredible dedication. I can't even imagine doing that for months without any end in sight.
This episode is sponsored by Superdog from Vitabiotics, the UK's number one vitamin company. Like all members of the family, your dog needs a balanced diet that includes a range of vitamins and minerals to stay healthy and full of vitality. Superdog's chewable, tasty braised beef tablets are packed with over 21 nutrients, expertly formulated for your special companion. Superdog's available now at Amazon, Ocado, Paws, Superdrug and Vitabiotics.com.
And also, you know, pet owners as well. You know, did you come across any people that refused to leave their, you know, towns or villages despite it being in a war zone because they couldn't leave their animals?
Yeah, absolutely. Like we said, if somebody has one cat or one small dog, it's not too complicated to travel with it. But if someone has three large dogs or eight cats, people stay for their animals. And it's just really, it's kind of inspiring and heartbreaking at the same time, you know, that they're so dedicated to their animals, but at the same time, they have to put themselves at risk. And, you know, every time they go out to a store, they're at risk of an explosion to take care of their animals. It's really hard to even fathom what their everyday life is like.
And I've been involved in animal welfare work for, you know, over 20 years now, but I've never worked in a war zone. Like, how does it feel doing this kind of work with this imminent threat of danger? I mean, you know, can you hear missiles over there? Can you hear, you know, gunfire? What does it feel like?
Yeah, well, we were very careful about sending our own personnel into Ukraine. And so we, of course, nothing is 100% safe, but we didn't go into any areas where that were actively under attack. But we did go to a lot of areas that had, you know, been under attack not too long ago. And you could see just, you know, burned out cars and, you know, houses with the roof collapsed or the entire house destroyed. And it's a little bit surreal because after some months of this, people just need to live their lives. So it starts to feel a little bit normal for the people there. You know, I mean, you might hide in the basement for days, but you're not going to do that for months. So despite all the chaos and the unpredictability, you know, people go to the supermarket, people walk their dogs, people need to live their lives, even if you don't know if tomorrow your local shopping center is going to be knocked down, or you don't know if you'll even have a country in the next year. But there's sort of surreal, this contrast of all this tragedy and chaos and people who just need to go to work and need to buy groceries.
And it all starts to become a bit normalized, doesn't it? And that kind of leads me on to the next question, which was around, you know, funding, because obviously there's always a huge public response, isn't there, when, you know, when these things first happen at the kind of the point of the crisis, if you like. But, you know, eventually media attention is diverted, diluted, other stories break, and people's attention is shifted, isn't it? And, you know, my question is, has that impacted on the amount of funds that are coming in? Have the general, you know, public been, you know, distracted, if you like, with other causes? Obviously, we've had some other significant global events since this happened. And this is, you know, people get a little bit kind of immune to the urgency of it. So has that impacted the fundraising efforts of you and your team?
Yeah, absolutely. In the first months of the crisis, we were receiving a lot of donations and a lot of public support, and it's really tapered off since then. And now, I mean, it's hard to say this, but we're needing to reduce the amount of dog and cat food that we're sending to Ukraine because we're not receiving enough donations to sustain it at the same level. You know, I've had to tell our partners, you know, okay, we're sending actually. Tomorrow we're going to send a truck full of food, so 20 tons of food to Kharkiv. And I told our partners we're sending a truck tomorrow, but I said, but I don't know when I can send food again. It might be 2 months until the next truck to Kharkiv. So please be careful, plan ahead, look for some other sources of support. And it's devastating to have to say that to them. But before the war, our work was Save the Dogs work was almost all in Romania, and we were raising enough money to cover the expenses in Romania. And now with the war in Ukraine, that's a huge additional expense, and we're not getting enough donations to sustain it. And so, it's hard as Ukraine isn't in the headlines as much as it was, and other disasters happen, and other things come into the news. That the support has been waning, but of course the needs of the animals have not been. There are still as many homeless dogs and cats as there were a year ago. It's a hard situation.
So what's the immediate support these animals need then? You mentioned food there. Is there anything else that they need? What else are you fundraising for?
Well, the most immediate needs are, dog and cat food to keep these animals alive and sterilization. So we are starting a new project starting in Odessa to sterilize street dogs and cats, you know, working with our networks of partners who have been feeding these animals for months, and also working with local vet clinics. That's the most urgent need. Those are the two most urgent needs right now. Yeah, food and funding to cover the cost of sterilization.
Because presumably, without that sterilization drive, we're going to end up with, you know, an exploding population of animals on the streets.
Exactly. Yeah, we're looking at an unthinkable crisis. You think all of the unsterilized animals on the streets, having litters of puppies and kittens, and in a few months, I don't even want to think about how many of these animals aren't going to survive.
And there's a huge focus, isn't there, at the moment on public health coming out of a pandemic, and, you know, looking at the situation with, you know, bird flu as well, this cross species movement of disease. Is there any overwhelming public health crisis that could be on the horizon with this exploding population of cats and dogs and other animals on the street?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, there is rabies in Ukraine. Of course, there are other common canine diseases, you know, parvovirus, distemper. And with so many unvaccinated animals in close proximity to each other roaming around, it could easily, I think diseases like that could easily spread. So that's another tragedy that we're trying to prevent by sterilizing the animals. And when I say sterilizing, I should say we're also sterilizing them and microchipping them and vaccinating them for rabies, so that, you know, the microchip is essential so that we can track them later. And if someone finds them, they'll know that it was sterilized and be able to identify the animal. And then, of course, the rabies vaccination to prevent a crisis like that, what you're talking about.
I mean, the situation does sound so desperate, Greg, but, you know, I don't want us to part on that note. Have you got any stories of people that have been reunited with their animals? Because that's the thing that I want to take away from this conversation, that there is hope. And you did say that there are people that are hoping to be reunited with animals. I'm not sure how they would do that, but have you got any stories or any examples of people that have been?
Yeah, we do. There have been people who, you know, refugees who escaped from Ukraine, and they needed to travel by plane, or they couldn't bring their pets with them, and they left their animals with Save the Dogs. You know, we brought them to our shelter, and then we transported them, you know, sometimes through a lot of complicated logistics, and brought them to either a family member of their former owner or back to the owner, and we reunited them. And I know, I mean, just not just that Save the Dogs has done this in Romania, but in other countries, including in the UK, you know, people have been reunited with their animals. And so it's, yeah, that those success stories are really what keep us going. And there also have been a lot of adoptions in Ukraine, you know, so many stories. I mean, the last time we were there, we visited someone in Mykolaiv who had some dogs before the war started. And she showed us, you know, a dog with, a dog with three legs, a dog with a permanent limp, a cat that had been abandoned and, you know, waited at a train station for months for its owners, and its owners never came back. So she adopted the cat. So there are a lot of success stories like these, you know, people who have really, you know, are pouring their hearts into this work and taking care of animals who are at their worst.
It's so tough, isn't it? Because obviously there's the trauma from the people side where they've had to abandon, you know, essentially members of their family. And I'm sure that has a huge and lasting psychological impact, but I guess added to all the other trauma of the war and the displacement. But then you've got these animals, like we've said, that aren't street animals. You know, they had comfortable lives, they had routines, and all of a sudden they're now in a situation, really traumatic situation, where their owners have abandoned them, and they're, you know, in this really scary, loud environment that with no certainty of food or shelter. I mean, it just must be horrific all round, really. But
yeah. And an important point, I think, is that people talk about, should you help the animals or help the people, and why help animals if you could help people? But I really don't think that's the right way to look at it. I mean, we've seen again and again that helping the animals and people ties together. You know, I mean, for example, you mentioned these people that have refused to leave Ukraine because of the animals they take care of, either their pets or street animals. And by supporting the animals, we're also supporting these people. You know, by helping people, people are finding so much comfort from the animals that they're rescuing. It gives them a purpose. It gives them the affection that we all know that pets can give us. And by it's all intertwined, you know, by helping these people to take care of the animals and helping them to rescue the animals, we're also helping the people.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And, you know, we've all got different relationships with our pets, haven't we? But, you know, I know from my personal experience, you know, my dog is definitely, you know, a member of the family. So I would really struggle with doing anything rather than, you know, taking him with me. So, Greg, just to give this a little bit of context, you say that, you know, we are desperate here for people to donate money. What kind of, you know, if somebody was sitting here today listening to this saying, I want to donate £10, £20, £50, what can this money pay for? What will it pay for?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I said, you know, sterilization and pet food are the most important needs. For about £12, you can feed a dog for a month. And so you know, for not a huge amount of money, you can literally keep a dog alive. I mean, these animals wouldn't be surviving without the support that we're giving. And so, you know, that's an easy way to make a difference. You know, you can sterilize a dog or a cat, prevent it from having puppies and kittens living in the streets, and some of whom aren't going to make it for, I think that's around 60 pounds. And so it's really possible for people to make a huge difference on the lives of animals through their donations.
And where can people go to donate?
Oh, thank you for asking. Well, our website is savethedogs.eu. So that you can go there and you can donate. Yeah, savethedogs.eu. And there's a link for the English version of the page. And then you can donate for Ukraine. You can read more about the work that Save the Dogs is doing.
So have you had any Ukrainian dogs at your shelter?
Yes. In the first month of the war, we were contacted through social media by Olga, who runs an animal shelter outside of Odessa. And she said her shelter, we went there a couple months ago, and her shelter is very close to a big antenna, which is used for, I think, satellite communication. So it was a target for the Russian military, and some of the Russian weapons missed and hit her shelter instead. And she said to us she had 150 dogs, but because some of her facilities were damaged, she couldn't take care of 30 of them. And she asked if we could help. And so this ended up being the biggest rescue that Save the Dogs had ever done. You know, we coordinated with her, found out about, you know, were these animals vaccinated? What was their behavior? Are they suitable to live in a home? She arranged vehicles to bring these dogs to the border. We got four of our own big vans to go to the border to meet her. Because of all the delay, I mean, she went through countless military checkpoints and didn't get to the border until the middle of the night. So, you know, in the dark, in the middle of the night, we were negotiating with the border officials and getting their approval to transfer these animals into our care. And then we brought them back to our shelter, and we had a big team out there in the dark, in the cold, organizing which dogs went into which dog runs and what groups they were in. And it was a massive undertaking, but it was a long road for these dogs, because a lot of them, some of them had heartworms, some of them had other diseases, some of them needed a lot of time with our behaviorists to become socialized enough so they could live in a home. But a lot of them are now living in loving homes around Europe, and some of them are still with us, and we're hoping that they'll still be adopted. And so it's, and we're still in touch with Olga almost every day now. And so, that was a really valuable way to help these animals during a time when, you know, the help was urgently needed and she had no one else to turn to.
And is Olga still in Ukraine with the remaining dogs at that shelter?
Yes, she is. And she now has even more dogs because so many have been abandoned, as well as some cats. Yeah, and she's out of work too. She hasn't earned any money for months and just somehow scrapes together the money to keep this animal shelter going. I don't know how she does it. It's really, it's an amazing effort in a really difficult situation.
And Greg, it just feels like there are so many people, including yourself and your team, that are really doing extraordinary things to save the lives of these animals over there. So from everybody that's listening, I just want to say a huge thank you. Please, please continue the work. And if you are listening to this podcast, please donate, because, you know, we need money. And Greg will agree with me, needs money to continue this absolutely vital work. Because we have had, you know, the humanitarian crisis, but this is for sure an animal welfare crisis, you know, on the horizon. So please, please, please donate.
Well, thank you so much. It's been really, really good to join you on the podcast. I appreciate it.
It's such a heart-wrenching situation. It's been really tough to talk about. Anybody with a pet listening to this will have felt the desperation and trauma of abandonment that these animals must have felt. But it's really important that people like Greg and the volunteers out there are working hard to save the lives of these animals. So please, 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 if you can, donate. And there's a couple of places you can do that. The website savethedogs.eu/en. You can donate there. But also the Blue Cross, who I work for, supporting a number of charities out there, including Save the Dogs. If you go on the Blue Cross website and look for the Pet Welfare Fund, they will make sure that that money is going directly to the animals that need it most.
You've been listening to The Consult Room. I really hope you've enjoyed today's show. Please do subscribe, follow, or share this podcast. I'd love to hear your feedback. If you want to get in touch or collaborate, then do reach out to us at theconsultroom.co.uk or connect with me on social media as Dr. Paul the Vet or Dr. Paul Magtalone.